This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Silent shock, the men behind the thalidomide scandal and an Australian family's long road to justice. It's an extraordinary read, an extraordinary saga, full of heartache, courage, I think, the courage of the family involved in this. 50 years of fighting to get any form of compensation or recognition of the wrongs that were done to people affected by thalidomide, the many, many thousands of people who were affected. And Michael's here to tell us about that long struggle in terms of getting justice for it. Now, justice for these people, rather. Okay, I think we should start, Michael.
Jill. That was ominous.
It was ominous. I think at the start, one of the things that we are going to explore as we go through this, and I've been interested, is I recall Michael very well from his days as a journalist, and he was a very, very good journalist, and now obviously he's a very, very good lawyer. And I'm interested there as we go along to look at the different ways in different professions and the disciplines and what we can actually bring in terms to fighting for struggle and justice for people in these situations, and what the law can do, and perhaps what the media can do as well, and how they might work together. Okay, now when you got into it, you'd been working in asbestos, so there was that class action, and then you were in Perth, I think, at the stage when you were drawn into thalidomide. How did that come about?
Well, can I just say, I've seen a few of our thalidomide clients in the audience, so a particular welcome to them without pointing anyone out. I was working in Perth for Slater and Gordon. I was running the asbestos diseases practice. As it actually turns out, asbestos diseases is a perfect training venue for thalidomide because, as you'll probably be aware, asbestos sits in people's lungs for decades prior to causing cancers and other illnesses. Thalidomide too, as it turned out, the thalidomide class action, people had been exposed 50 years earlier, so there was a lot of piecing together what had happened 50 years earlier. I was running the asbestos diseases practice. Peter Gordon, who had been the senior partner at Slater's, had left to do his own thing. Serendipitously, he had bought a house from a official thalidomide survivor, a beach house. A man who was a builder, is a builder. And Peter had become interested, just by pure chance, in thalidomide, and this fellow had told him that he was one of about 36 Australians who were recognised as thalidomide survivors in the 1970s, given relatively small compensation sums. He was doing well, this particular fellow, but there were many who had run out of compensation, ageing bodies, some in many cases parents as carers who were reaching their mid-late 70s, and these people were in difficulty. So Peter and Ken Udale, the father of an Australian thalidomider, organised some extra compensation. I say that quickly, it was a big effort, but organised some extra compensation for these people. But then Peter had become interested in the thalidomiders who were never compensated because of a variety of failures in the 1970s. Many people didn't get compensated. And he called me up in Perth, told me that he was looking into a class action and would I like to come work with him. There was a whole section of the book about my reservations and about my concerns about working with Peter, all good things about Peter, but I mean, I'm a bit of a control freak at times, and I knew Peter was a control freak. Wasn't sure how we'd go together. I shudder now to think that, you know, my demands and conditions nearly led me to missing out on the litigation, but we worked it out, and we worked together really well for 3 years, and I moved back to Melbourne to work on it, so very glad I did. It really was a once-in-a-lifetime case.
And the work centred particularly on Lynette's case and her mother, Wendy Rowe.
That's right.
Before we get into the massive investigations in the case, it's very important in these class actions, isn't it, to get the right test case.
You've got to get the very best lead plaintiff you can get. Ultimately, the class action had exactly 107 people in it. One of those people have to go first. And it's not who was first in line. It's not who you like most. It's not who's can afford it. It's none of those things. It's who has the best chance of winning, because if you lose the lead plaintiff's claim, you've really lost the class. you've got to win the lead plaintiff's claim in order to pave the way for the rest of the people. So in Lynn's case, Lynn Rowe ultimately was the lead plaintiff in the claim. Lynn was born in March 1962, so her mum had taken the drug in June, July 1961. That was critical for a bunch of reasons. It was towards the end of the period of availability of thalidomide, so the knowledge of the drug company had grown over the period, and they were most culpable as time passed. There was also an Australian doctor had blown the whistle in early June 1961, told the distillers company in Sydney that he thought it was causing malformations in babies. So anyone exposed after that time had a really solid claim on liability, because it wasn't just a question of they should have realised, they could have, if they'd looked at the drug chemistry and all of that. Fact is, they'd been told by William McBride in June 1961 that he thought it was malforming and killing babies. So Lynn was exposed after that.
So Lynn was conceived in July.
Lynn was actually conceived earlier. Her mum took the drug about 4 weeks later. So the drug is dangerous in the second month of pregnancy. So I think she was conceived. One of these funny things, I spent a lot of time talking to Wendy about conception. And it was complicated by the fact that they had they had two children at that point. And the older one was only 3 months old,
yeah.
3 or 4 months old. So Wendy and I had these, what could have been awkward discussions, but because Wendy was such a sensational client, plaintiff, woman, they weren't. So I think Lynn was conceived at about the start of June. Wendy took the drug at about the start of July 1961.
And there was plenty of indication then to the company that the drug was causing problems.
Yes. Well, there were all of the, can we call them general indications, like it was causing terrible nerve damage in people who were taking the drug.
In adults. Yeah.
In adults or children who were taking the drug. It's called peripheral neuritis, damaged the nerve endings in feet and hands. It hadn't been tested in pregnant animals, they hadn't followed up pregnant women. They were recommending it as ultra safe. They were recommending it for pregnancy. They were doing all sorts of negligent things. But to top all that off, and what made Lynn's case so much stronger again, was that in June 61, distillers had gone to William McBride at the end of 1960 and said, would you try this? So he was trialling it at the drug company's request. He comes back to them and says, I think it's killed three of my patients' babies in June 61. So anyone, you can see as a lawyer, anyone exposed after that date had a red-hot claim in negligence. But Lynn was also the lead plaintiff because her situation was so severe. Lynn was born without limbs, entirely without limbs. Her parents, who were then in their mid and late 70s, had been caring for her 24/7 for 50 years. They couldn't go on physically doing it for much longer. So that lent urgency to the case, which meant we had a good argument for, as lawyers call it, expedition, but for a speeded-up process, which was really critically important because lawyers... Nothing forces sanity on lawyers like a looming trial date. I mean, that's us. We were just as capable of idiocy as the defendant lawyers. But the fact that we got on a fast track, the judge imposed a trial date because of the urgency of Lynn's case, forced us down it towards trial, made for much more sensible behaviour. There was one very funny moment. The lawyers write each other ridiculous letters. I mean, we try to restrain ourselves, but unsuccessfully. On and on and on and on. At one point, the judge's associate wrote to us and said, His Honour has asked me to remind you that there is only one His Honour and there are plenty of you. He cannot waste his time reading all of your letters. Please stop. Because we were writing each other letters and then sending them to the court. It was demented. But he was a terrific judge and forced it on, which was a great thing.
At the time, the German manufacturers were trying to disrupt that by saying, no, any compensation hearing should be here in Germany, weren't they?
Yeah, just a crazy idea. We thought it was a completely crazy idea. It turned out to be a completely crazy idea. The judge knocked it out of the park. But the idea that Lynn, whose mum had taken the drug in Melbourne, who was born in Melbourne, whose doctors were in Melbourne, her lawyers were in Melbourne, didn't speak German... survived on welfare, could and finds it hard to travel to the city, let alone get on air Lufthansa and fly to Germany. I mean, the idea that she should be sent to Germany to litigate her claim was demented.
There are parallels, aren't there, in terms of, like, with the asbestos settlement. It seemed that would be dragged on and on and on until everyone died and they wouldn't have to pay. And with this, we can see, too, the obstacles that were put in the path of people just trying to find out the truth are quite extraordinary, the way people behaved.
It is, and there was a real... So we issued against both... The drug was invented by Grünenthal, a German company which came into existence after the Second World War. It was the spin-off of an existing soap and perfume company. There was a boom in synthetic drugs after the war, and this company wanted to make hay while the sun shone. So they set up a company called Grünenthal. Grünenthal invented the drug, licensed other companies to sell it around the world. One of those companies was Distillers. And Distillers sold it in Australia. So we sued both Grünenthal...
Along with Johnny Walker. I mean, it does seem amazing that the drug distributor in Australia, Distillers. Really. And so we wonder about the oversight there and the medical overview of what they were actually distributing.
You think they might have been 0.05 while distributing?
It just seems remarkable.
Yeah. No, it is. So we sued them both. And ultimately... Distillers, which is now part of Diageo, a multi-billion-dollar drinks company. I mean, they fought hard. They brought their own applications. They were as painful in their own way as Grünenthal, but they ultimately saw the sense of settling and settled. And Grünenthal, I mean, it's in Grünenthal's DNA that they did no wrong. It's complete fiction. It's totally false. But they believe to this day that they did nothing legally wrong in relation to thalidomide, and they refused to pay a cent, so far as we're aware. So it was Diageo that picked up the tab eventually. Grünenthal didn't pay, and, you know...
Had they ever been forced to pay anything, the manufacturers?
Well, they haven't been forced. In the wake of the disaster in 19... So the drug was withdrawn in late 1961. It was on the market from 58 to 61. Two doctors, one in Germany and one in Sydney, Australia, cottoned onto the link. There was this worldwide boom in malformations, and not just any malformations. It was really severe, often quite typical.
And often killed the babies.
And often killed the baby. At least, you know, half of the babies who were born with these malformations did not survive. So there was this worldwide boom. But curiously, it wasn't... First of all, the boom in these malformations wasn't even noticed. So this epidemic of... You know, this disastrous epidemic wasn't even picked up for several years. And then it was picked up, and there was this... in Germany, there was this search for the cause. And it's a little like the search for the cause of lung cancer, because in early last century, lung cancer was a very rare disease. But with the uptake of smoking, particularly after the First World War, lung cancers, a lag of 20 years, lung cancers became more and more common. And in the late 40s and the 50s, there was this... search among epidemiologists for what was causing this lung cancer boom. And was it car exhaust? Because cars had just become really popular. So was it car exhaust? Was it some sort of fumes from tar on the roads? Was it tobacco? And it really wasn't until the early mid-50s that tobacco was pinged. And the same thing went on in Germany in relation to the limb malformations, largely. The doctors who were on the hunt thought maybe it was detergent, maybe it was a contraceptive, and that they had their list of things, but there was one particular German doctor who connected it, and Dr. William McBride in Sydney, who was trialling it at the request of the drug company, also connected it sort of at the same time, and that's really what caused it to be withdrawn. So that's a very long-winded way of saying that in the late 60s, the German executives at Grünenthal were charged with negligent manslaughter, very unusual event, over thalidomide. The trial ultimately collapsed after two and a half years. There was just the government was overwhelmed by the resources that Grünenthal poured into defending it, and Grünenthal put up a compensation fund for German victims. The government matched it. The trial was over, and Grünenthal got immunity from suit in Germany. So Grünenthal put up the money then, and really hasn't been forced to pay since.
An extraordinary company, really, with a long history after that of using Nazi scientists.
I mean, That's one of the differences between litigating and writing the book. Mm. In the litigation, there were ferocious debates in the office about what we could do with Grünenthal's Nazi history.
Yeah.
Because the guy in charge of thalidomide at Grünenthal had been a Nazi doctor in the Second World War experimenting with typhus vaccinations on Poles in occupied Poland. And then he was charged, but he got back to Germany and ended up in charge of thalidomide at Grünenthal and given a percentage of sales on the drug. So here you had a man, a doctor with a very dubious history, in charge of a drug where reports of negative side effects were flooding in. And, you know, you wonder it's little surprise to me that a man with that history didn't do anything about it.
They were still putting in people with that kind of history, though, in the 70s?
Well, Later. That's right. I mean, the most amazing thing about Grünenthal, and it's still amazing when I say it out loud, is they have the disaster in the 50s and 60s. Their executives are charged with negligent manslaughter in the late 60s. They get off very fortunately in the early 70s. And in the mid-70s, they appoint a man who'd been convicted and jailed for mass murder and slavery at Auschwitz as the chairman of their board. I mean, they were so brazen and so shameless that a convicted mass murderer served as the chairman of their board. I find that, I talk to people who are sort of experts in German history because obviously there's a special context to Germany. There were, millions of former members of the Nazi parties, but there were not millions of convicted mass murderers.
No.
So there was there's no justification for having employed that fellow.
It's extraordinary the way the company has behaved and just acted in absolute denial ever since. And it does remind me a bit of that book, Albert Speer and His Battle with Truth.
Oh, yeah.
Very much. It just, I didn't know. And it's so blatantly obvious.
No,
they
that's right.
Knew.
I read that book a long, long time ago, but I thought at the end of that book, Gitta Sereni, maybe drew some sort of admission from him. I can't remember. But certainly there's never been an admission from Grünenthal. They are deep, deep in the bunker.
Now, when you met Lynn and it was decided that this would be your lead case, how confident were you at that time that you would be able to get the goods on distillers?
Well, I mean, I'd be lying if I said we were super confident. This is a very big unknown.
Well, it's hard too emotionally with a client who's got such needs and expectations, has been through so much, that what you're going through with the case too, it's going to be big.
Yes. Well, I mean, I still remember going out to the Rose home for the first time. It was in early 2012, I think, 2011. And I remember preparing. I hadn't met Lynn. I knew Lynn was... I mean, Lynn, the family had called our office a couple of months earlier before I'd got to Melbourne. I remember preparing myself emotionally. But the thing about the Rose was that... I mean, the thing about the Rose is that they're so extraordinarily straightforward, matter-of-fact, generous but realistic that, they understood... I mean... In some ways, as a former journalist and now a lawyer, there's something very honest about the legal relationship you have, perhaps as opposed to the journalistic relationship. We told the Rose up front that it was a tough, tough claim. We were litigating 50 years after the event. Even pulling together the evidence that Wendy had taken the drug would be difficult. But then we had to establish that by the standards of 1961, the company should have realised that they were exposing Lynn in utero to a risk. All of that was going to be hard. We had to pore through medical texts and talk to elderly doctors and discover what was known about the placental barrier in 1961. And it was clearly going to be a huge hurdle. But the Rose understood all of that. They had plenty of difficult questions about the litigation. They wanted to understand it and the risks and the benefits and everything else. But once they committed to the process, they were in, and they were just tremendous. I mean, I keep saying Lynn was our client, but it was really Lynn and her parents, Wendy and Anne, and they were just tremendous.
And so you tracked down so many people involved in this, including the doctor who delivered Lynn.
Mm.
And it's interesting that the title of the book, Silent Shock, really has two kind of relevant references, don't they? And one was to when Lynn was born.
Yes. So early on, Wendy had told me the name of the doctor who delivered Lynn, and his name is Dr. Ron Dickinson, and I eventually found him. He was living in retirement down on the Mornington Peninsula. On the day of Lynn's birth, he had not been Wendy's doctor through the pregnancy. Mm. The doctor who'd attended her through the pregnancy couldn't be found on the day, and so the hospital asked Dr. Dickinson to step in. Would you mind delivering a baby? We have a woman deep into labour. And he said, sure, of course. He knew he was a doctor at the practice where Wendy went, so he knew the family. He stepped in, and I took him to lunch, and we had some phone conversations, took him to lunch, and we talked about that day. And it was very emotional for me. It was very emotional for him. But he talked 50 years later. It was crystal clear for him. It was the era before ultrasounds and scans. He had no pre-warning of what was to come. And he talked about how first Lynn emerged without arms and then without legs. He was open about it being the most distressing moment in a 50-year medical career. And then he had to break the news to Wendy, and he talked about how nothing had prepared him for that moment. What do you say? And he decided to be completely honest and as gentle as possible, and he just leaned over and told Wendy that her daughter had been born without limbs. He gave us a statement. It wasn't just that was helpful. In fact, he talked about how the distillers sales reps had visited the surgery, had given them free samples of the drug, had spruiked it as being ultra safe. The great ironic thing about the drug was that the sales pitch for thalidomide was that it was super safe, a revolution in drug safety. Grünenthal had found that no matter how much you stuffed into the mouth of a test animal, you couldn't do anything but put it to sleep.
So if a child took it from a cupboard or accidentally got hold of it, it'd be okay.
And so that was their pitch. And their famous ad, or the famous ad that distillers used, was a kid up on a stool reaching into a medicine cabinet, grabbing hold of a bottle, and the text reads, the kid's in danger, but if it's thalidomide, he'll be safe. It's total nonsense, of course, because anyone, any doctor, any medically trained person knows that, first of all, you can't extrapolate from animals to humans. Just because you stuff a lot down a test animal's mouth doesn't mean. The other thing is that a one-off dose is very different from taking a drug continually over a longer period. And also, even then, the fetus was known, or the embryo and the fetus were known to be quite different in their biological makeup.
This is an interesting point about it, isn't it? That with many other drug companies at the time, they were doing their testing on animals to see if it would affect the fetus. And Grünenthal was trying to make out then that, oh no, that wasn't really standard practice. You didn't have to test to see if it would cause any problems to the embryo or fetus.
That's right. The responsible and reputable companies of the era, and it's all through the records and the medical journal articles and their internal records, were testing it. It was called reproductive testing. They would give it to successive generations of pregnant animals and look for problems in the offspring. Grünenthal didn't bother with any of that stuff. Grünenthal and distillers were both from the get-rich-quick school of pharmaceuticals. Their testing, in every sense, was lacking. Distillers were actually conned, really, by Grünenthal into believing that all the relevant testing had been done, and distillers just accepted Grünenthal's assurances that they were getting an ultra-safe drug, and away they went. Very quickly, the sort of safety extended to everything, and distillers specifically spruiked the drug as safe in pregnancy, safe for mother and child.
And even when distillers got the information from McBride that there were concerns, they sat on that. They didn't do anything with
it. No. Well, this is one of the big... This really was one of the big turning points of the litigation. McBride told distillers in June 1961... Remember, he'd been trialling it at the request of distillers. Mm. Distillers had given him 200 sample packs of their drug to try it on his pregnant patients, and very quickly he started using it for morning sickness. Very odd conception of morning sickness in those days. The idea was just sedate the mum as much as possible, it'll cure her morning sickness. McBride wasn't the only doctor doing that, it was pretty widespread. So he started doing that, thought that he'd found a miracle cure for morning sickness, and then 8 months after he started trialing it, his patients started giving birth to malformed babies who quickly died. He went back to distillers, told them. Distillers' story always had been for 48 years, that McBride's report had got stuck with one irresponsible salesman. Hadn't made it up into the senior hierarchy of the company, just got stuck, and it was another 6 months before McBride came back with yet further dead infants, and then they did something. That was Distiller's story, but we managed to find a number...
Entry of Woody Woodhouse, who's a great character.
A great character, a great man, a great character. A complex man, a great character. Woody... So we found a number of... this is where the journalism came in pretty handy. I mean, really, I knew that if we could find people who'd sold the drug in the 1960s, that would be gold. And so it proved. We found a couple of people who... I found three salesmen from the early 60s who'd sold the drug in Australia. One of them, Woody Woodhouse, had worked at the Sydney head office. And I had a series... I flew up to Sydney, spent a lot of time talking to Woody, and it was no difficulty because he, as many drug salesmen are, was a very charming... interesting man, told good stories, enjoyed, they live on their wits and their charm. And even in his mid-80s, he was just a terrific fellow.
And a good man with a conscience.
He really had a conscience. He had a conscience. And so I drew up an affidavit for Woody because I wanted his account of the drug. And I knew that we weren't quite getting to the nub of it, but thalidomide was a difficult subject for... It was a difficult subject for our clients, for their parents, for relatives, and it was for the salesman who'd sold it because this, they'd... No fault attached to them. They were told it was super safe. Mm. And they'd sold it as such. And so ultimately, maybe my fifth trip to Sydney, I went up to see Woodhouse with my... Woody, with my finished affidavit for him, and I said, Woody, we've got a trial in 4 months... It's been a great pleasure, but we really have to sign you up now. If there's anything further you've got, please tell me. And I knew that there was something further because the McBride story was rubbish. It was just complete rubbish. I knew it was.
The aspect of it being buried.
The story that he told one person and it had got lost. Yeah. And so Woody and I went for... He said, let's go for a drive. We had a look at the old distiller's headquarters in Sydney, which was now a Europe car. Building painted green. I took some photos. I'd become the world's biggest thalidomide history buff by this stage. And then we got back to his house and Woody said, well, let's sit down and let's talk about McBride's warning because I know that's really what you're interested in. And Woody told me it was the once-in-a-lifetime case and a once-in-a-lifetime witness. And Woody said, look, the truth about McBride's warning is that everyone at Distillers knew. Bill Poole, the managing director, Skinner, the accountant... Fred Strobel, the national sales director, and others. We all knew that they all knew, and they would sit around drinking whiskey.
Johnny Walker
whiskey at night. After the staff had gone home, the senior manager would sit around drinking whiskey, talking about how if McBride was right, it would destroy the business. Mm. And during that same period, they kept selling it, not only... broadly, but also to maternity hospitals, to obstetricians.
It's very hard to conceive of men sitting down having those conversations.
It's just about impossible, isn't it? And they were also furiously trying to get it onto the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. And in anticipation of getting a government subsidy for the drug, they built up a stockpile of 8 million pills out the back of their Sydney premises, ready to flood the market. Once they'd got the government subsidy, which would lead to increased sales, with a drug that they knew their own test doctor had told them was killing babies. It's totally unbelievable.
Can I ask you, I know that William McBride's had a very checkered history, and there's no doubt he did some great work there. Do we know, though, if Dr. McBride was actually prescribing thalidomide to his patients after he already had suspicions about it?
No. His suspicions developed in May and June. That's not an area about... I mean, one assumes that after he realised that it... After he thought that it was killing babies, that he stopped using it. And I think that is the case. He certainly told distillers in June 1961. Mm. He told distillers, he told a salesman... he started doing tests on animals in the basement of the Crown Street Hospital. But McBride was no teratologist or embryologist or developmental biologist. He was an obstetrician. He had no idea what to do with his animal tests. All he did was shove crushed up thalidomide pills into the mouths of pregnant, I think, guinea pigs. And he didn't get anything. And he started to wonder. And it wasn't until his human patients gave birth to further malformed babies in about October 1961 that he was utterly convinced, went back to the distiller and said, "What are you doing? I told you months ago that I thought the drug was killing babies. Why haven't you done anything?"
And if they had have listened to him, in all likelihood, it would have been at that point just before, say, Wendy would have been prescribed with it.
That's right. And that's why Wendy's, Lynn's claim was so strong, because McBride told them on Queen's birthday weekend in 1961, early June, Wendy wasn't exposed until 2 or 3 weeks later. Had distillers acted appropriately, got the warning out, told its salesman to just tell doctors to stop using it, Dr. Yu Indian in Nunawading wouldn't have given Wendy Rose samples. So, I mean, it was tight. The time frame's tight. 2 or 3 weeks in 1961. You have to act quickly, but certainly they could have done it and they should have avoided it.
Well, if it's contaminated berries, we get them off the shelves pretty quickly. It is quite extraordinary how quickly authorities can move they have concerns.
No, absolutely. Look, the world was a little slower then. That wouldn't have happened quite as quickly.
Yeah.
Doctors wouldn't have got emails, but they could act. You know, when they decided to act at the end of November in 1961, they got word out very quickly. I should say, I mean, I'm demonising distillers and its behaviour here. Grünenthal over in Germany were behaving in a way that defies belief. I mean, they had two doctors and a pharmacist contact them about their own suspicions about malformations. Grünenthal showed no interest at all, didn't seek to examine the medical records, talk to the doctors, look at the child, speak to mum, nothing, just kept assuring people that it was safe. And Grünenthal was also being buried under a tidal wave of reports of nerve damage. And, you know, Grünenthal's response to the warnings of nerve damage really had to be seen to be believed. I went to the archives in Germany to look at the German prosecutor's documents, because when the trial collapsed, the German prosecutor put his documents into an archive. And Grünenthal was hiring private...
They're good like that.
Germans are ruthlessly organised. It was... tremendous. These folders came out of archives, pristine,
brilliantly catalogued,
unbelievable. It was amazing. I was very, grateful for Teutonic organisation and everything else. It was terrific. But Grünenthal were hiring private detectives to spy on doctors, bullying editors of magazines not to run things, getting people to pose as patients and going to doctors' clinics and pretend to have symptoms and see what the doctors would say. And there was one report by a Grünenthal salesman that for me really illustrated Grünenthal's outrageous behaviour, and that was a Grünenthal salesman. He was a doctor. Grünenthal used a lot of doctors as salesmen. Went off in the middle of 1961, by which time Grünenthal knew that it was causing massive nerve damage. And this salesman went to a hospital that had both a general wing and a psychiatric wing. And he expected to find nerve damage because he and his company secretly knew it was causing lots of nerve damage. And in his report to the company, he said, in the general wing, as expected, heaps of thalidomide damage, lots of complaints, lots of side effects. And then he said, in the psychiatric wing, despite massive use of the drug, no reports at all. And he thought that was ridiculous. And he concluded his report to headquarters with, "Perhaps the idiots love it when it burns." You know, by which he meant the psych patients were so disturbed they hadn't realised that their symptoms were caused by the drug that they were taking.
Mm.
You know, so it was that kind of cavalier, callous approach that Grünenthal brought to dealing with these reports.
It's interesting if we look at how other countries dealt with some aspects of this. In the UK, when there was a shabby little compensation deal done, the press was actually stronger there, the Sunday Telegraph.
Sunday Times.
Was that just before Murdoch bought it?
It was before Murdoch bought it.
Right. But they actually spent years investigating and invested a lot of resources in it, and I don't know many media companies that would be able to do that now and did it. So there was some good work there done from the media side and a few not so good lawyers back at that time in the UK.
I think that's fair.
Whereas in the United States, there was an extraordinary woman, a doctor, who I understand is still alive.
She's alive. She's 100 years old.
This woman basically saved Americans from thalidomide.
She really did. It was as it's as simple as that. Mm. She her name's Frances Kelsey. Mm. She was at the time she was 46 or 47 years old. So she, you know, she would she had a medical degree. She had a pharmacology degree. She had this enormous kind of varied experience. Mm. She was a mum. She had two girls, and she had just arrived at the FDA. The thalidomide application from the American licensee, so the German company had licensed an American company to sell it, but America was ahead of most of the world and you had to get approval to sell the drug in America. You didn't have to here or in the UK, but the American FDA had some authority, and so they had to get Frances Kelsey to agree that they could sell it. And Kelsey thought that the application was full of garbage, overblown claims, poor science, just nonsense, and she knocked it back. And she kept knocking it back. And in early 61, she even said to them, it's causing nerve damage in adults. Have you checked to see what it might be doing to a fetus? And they said, oh, no, we haven't. And they tried to persuade her with some sort of late in pregnancy results, which she said, late in pregnancy, the baby's almost fully formed. They're not vulnerable. I want to know what's happening early in pregnancy when the embryo, or the, it's really the embryo at that stage, when the embryo is really vulnerable to insult. And they said, well, we don't know, we'll have to look. And she kept knocking it back until the information emerged in other parts of the world what it was doing. Kennedy had her to the White House, gave her a Congressional Medal of Honor. The FDA got new powers to regulate drugs. She became a national hero. There's schools named after her, an annual medal for bravery in the public service. She's still alive. Obama gave her another medal a couple of years ago, but it was truly a heroic, brave, yes, smart, gutsy. I mean, the drug company went behind her back, threatened her with libel, pressured her, asked her senior officials to sack her. She resisted and resisted. She was a very tough woman.
Yeah, it's a great story. If we look at the systems now that are in place, could this happen again?
Yes. I mean, the fact is there are drug disasters. I mean, there are drug problems and side effects all the time. Whether you could have such a catastrophic disaster, the answer is no. I mean, in this era of mass communication, it wouldn't take 15,000 malformed and dead babies for the alarm to
be
raised.
Our
communications are better. Also, I mean, thalidomide did change the way drugs are regulated. Mm. We got the TGA. I mean, the FDA got new powers. It was a dramatic change to regulation all around the world. I mean, these days, in terms of a drug's teratogenic or its potential to harm the unborn child, drug companies have to test on multiple animal models, pregnant animal models. They have to do small-scale clinical trials. They have to rigorously follow up on women who take the drug early in pregnancy. There are all sorts of measures now to prevent this happening again, even on a small scale. Truth is, though, that every time a pregnant woman takes a new drug, there's an element of uncertainty because all the animal models in the world cannot predict what it does inside a human being. I mean, thalidomide is, in rats, for example, thalidomides cause the embryo, in a high enough dose, cause the embryo to die and be reabsorbed into the placental lining, but it's very hard to cause malformed rat babies. I mean, humans are ultra-sensitive. In terms of the animal world, humans are very sensitive to thalidomide in pregnancy. So it's very hard.
One dose could have...
A single tablet, and in lots of cases, a single tablet taken somewhere in the second month of pregnancy caused catastrophic damage to a baby. There's many, many cases where it was just a single tablet.
And devastating, utterly devastating for so many families who couldn't get any answers, couldn't get any assistance. No help, no compensation. Right.
And for those babies who were born before... I mean, the babies who were born before it became known what was happening, there was just, you know, no answers for parents. So they spent some time in the complete dark. I mean, aside from the tragedy and the trauma of the day, where an anticipated joyous event turns to, you know, real trauma, and then coming to grips with, you know, a changed reality, lifelong reality. Then there were, I mean, there's one family in the book, a New Zealand family. He was a salesman for distillers. He sold the drug and he promoted it as safe because he believed the pitch. And his own wife was pregnant and she was taking it for morning sickness. And
at the time it was withdrawn.
Had taken it. So the baby was... she was 4 or 5 months into pregnancy when it was withdrawn. I spoke to this fellow. He actually died during the litigation, but he gave us a statement and I remember speaking to him. He was a devout Catholic. He and his wife were both devout Catholics. So she was 5 months pregnant. Mm. She had taken a lot of this drug early in pregnancy. And he told me how the two of them, you know, got on their knees and prayed hand in hand through the remainder of the pregnancy that their baby would be okay. And, of course, their baby wasn't okay. And so, you know, just the scale of the suffering the drug caused is immense.
Just extraordinary. How much did it affect you? Because when you came to covering this case, you didn't have any children.
No, I didn't.
And now you have three.
Now I have three. It all happened very quickly. And it was totally...
Worked out how, though, now.
So totally unrelated to the litigation. And I am... although I did develop, an unseemly and unwelcome paranoia about what my partner was ingesting.
Yeah.
She was not at all pleased with some of my interventions. But I naturally became hypersensitive about the whole thing. Nicole was 7 months pregnant when I started work on thalidomide. So we had our first baby in February 2011, and I was out at the Rose maybe 2 months later, and I remember asking Wendy as an aside, and this time I was suffering perfectly run-of-the-mill sleep deprivation, nothing to make a song and dance over, but, you know, of course, I felt traumatised. And I remember saying to Wendy as an aside, when did Lynn first sleep through the night? Wendy laughed and said, what do you mean she has never slept through the night? And she said that 50 years on, Lynn, who, you know, cannot move herself in bed, Lynn cries out 3 times a night. Wendy gets up 3 times a night to move Lynn in the bed, give her a bedpan, do something. So, you know, 48 years on, Wendy was closing in on 50 years of interrupted sleep without complaint, which sort of, you know, gave me something to
pretty amazing
think about.
Family.
Yeah. Extraordinary family. And the sense of humour they brought to it too. I mean, I am not a religious person. And I was always intrigued by the family's faith because... You know, they've coped in the most extraordinary circumstances and faith was definitely a part of it. The parents had met it in a Christian youth group and Wendy's, they're not proselytisers or anything else, but they're people of deep faith. And I think Wendy would say that her faith has perhaps diminished a little over the years, but it's still there. So that's been a massive support to them. Also, they approached the whole thing with good grace and humour, which is not to say that it hasn't been outrageously difficult and painful and hard at times, because it has. But Lynn particularly is funny. I mean, Lynn suffered some brain damage after birth because she lapsed into she developed a fever, and thalidomide babies generally lack surface area, and so they don't expel heat effectively. So the temperature spiked. She went into a coma. She suffered some mild brain damage. She's funny and witty and endearing. And my favourite ever joke of Lynn's is when she... I went out to see her talk a lot of times because I had to really understand the situation. And she spoke to a group of gymnastics instructors down in Paran. And she opened up with, I'm Lynn Rowe. I don't always want to speak with me because I'm not very good at the parallel bars. Which I thought was just a great joke. Not just, I'm no good at them, I'm not very good, as if, you know, she's sort of a little bit good.
It must have been just the most wonderful day when it settled that they would get something after all that time.
I mean, I feel, you know, I'm feeling a bit goosebumpy now thinking about it. It was, I mean, and it was wonderful because it was a fantastic result for a fantastic, deserving family. I mean, this was litigation as I love it. It was a morality tale. Mm. But on the one hand, we had the Rowe family. On the other, we had big pharmaceutical companies who had made massive profits out of an outrageously dangerous drug, promoted it as super safe, behaved in disgraceful ways, had never really, Grünenthal particularly, had never taken responsibility for the drug. So we had got the family a fantastic result, which was really life-changing for them. I mean, they look fantastic today. I mean, their fear about what will happen to Lynn when the parents can no longer care has been removed. But also we knew that getting a good result for Lynn made getting a good result for everyone else that much closer.
Are there people who have fallen through the cracks of getting compensation?
There are disappointed people. I mean, we were approached, I mean, we were contacted by a lot of people. Mm. Ultimately, we went forward with, I think, 107. I might be one or two out. There were other people we had to tell that there was simply no way that they were going to succeed. There was a group of people who were, I mean, a lot of people think they are thalidomiders. We had to tell some of them that they couldn't possibly be because their birth dates were before the drug was invented or many years after it was withdrawn. Just couldn't be. And there were others who maybe they were, but there was just no way we were ever going to prove it. I mean, this was a legal claim and, you know, we had to be able to... I mean, our criteria were not super rigorous. We let a lot of people in. We got a lot of people in who, if you'd had to litigate their case individually in court, would not have succeeded.
Yes.
And we had a very good scheme for that. But certainly there are people who... There are some people who felt disappointed at the end.
It's been great. Now we're going to take some questions.
Thank you. I just wondered what percentage of women that took the drug did end up with problems?
That's a great question, and there's a sort of scientific divide. And so if I can refine the question to what percentage of women who took the drug in the sensitive period, so if you took it in the eighth month or the seventh month, you know, generally speaking, no problems. Some people think maybe some neurological problems. But if you took it in the second months of pregnancy, the estimates range between probably 50 and 80%. It's inexplicable why some people weren't damaged, even when their mums took a lot of the drug in that period. But then some people, you know, there's all sorts of DNA differences in all of us, why some are more resistant to some things. Some people worked in the mine at Whitnum and never developed mesothelioma, for example. It's really not understood to this day how the drug actually works, how it does cause malformations. I mean, these days it's an anti-cancer drug used in multiple myeloma. It's also useful in leprosy. I mean, they're still refining their understanding of how the drug is, by what mechanism it's useful in those indications. And the best guess is that it was 50 to 80%. There was no possibility really of doing sort of randomised clinical trials in humans about that question because all of the epidemiology was done in retrospect. Like the drug caused a disaster, it was withdrawn from the market, then doctors had to go back and try to figure out what it had done, what injuries it had caused. And so some of these questions are still a bit open, but it's certainly more than 50% and it's certainly less than 90%.
Thank you. You mentioned how the result of this has changed things like the FDA approval system and the Therapeutic Goods Administration. But from a legal point of view, you've won your case. Is that influencing people in other countries who've also suffered under this? Obviously not the US because they would be lawyers straight away, but you've mentioned why that didn't happen. What about in the UK and other markets where this drug was also administered?
Yes, so we won our case. We didn't win it at a trial, of course. We didn't have a trial in the end. On the eve of the trial in 2012, Diageo decided it had had enough. I mean, you know, we never really were privy to Diageo's internal decision-making about that, but I think they realised we had a very strong claim. This was going to be a very embarrassing trial with Woodhouse and others giving very embarrassing evidence. They'd be stuck in the dock, so to speak, with Grünenthal for an extended period, which nobody would want. There would be reputational damage. And Diageo is a company that makes its money from booze. And booze is probably the biggest damager of babies in utero in the world today through fetal alcohol syndrome. So this was Diageo is very sensitive to its public reputation. I think we were fortunate to have them as a defendant, but they settled and settled very sensibly. We won through a settlement. There's litigation in the US and in the UK. The way they benefit from our experience is that they know it's possible. They can access some of our materials and sort of the expert evidence that we marshalled. Slater and Gordon is involved in the UK litigation. We provided assistance in the US. The UK is sort of a different kettle of fish because there was massive publicity attached to thalidomide in the UK. there's been a very active... The thalidomide in the UK are really a very active lobby group. There's been a lot of information about the drug, and I think most of the people came forward over the years. There's a UK thalidomide trust that's taken applications year by year, and so people have joined that over the years since the 70s. There isn't the same kind of uncompensated group in the UK as there were here, so the litigation is on a smaller scale. The US is just hard, a massive country. Despite Kelsey's best efforts in the US, so the company came to her and said, can we sell it? She said, no way. Persuade me that it's safe. There was a loophole in the FDA regulations at the time which said that a company could conduct clinical trials without any approval from the FDA. The drug company, Richardson Merrill, wanted to familiarise doctors in the US with their drug in advance of getting FDA approval. So what they did was just distribute 3 million pills across the US to doctors and say, here it is, it's fantastic, run your own little clinical trial, tell us how you go. It wasn't a clinical trial in any sense. It was a marketing familiarisation process. But that's why there are victims in the US, but it's very hard to find them. So the litigation there is moving very slowly and is kind of bogged down in procedural issues, I think, in Pennsylvania. But certainly the success of the Australia-New Zealand litigation here gave other lawyers, Spain as well, confidence that it could be done.
Did they try to dump the drug on any third world countries or anything like that when they started?
They sold it all over the place. Well, I mean, these days, it's the biggest drama these days is in the third world, because it's a cancer drug and it's a leprosy drug. In the first world, its use is attended by really serious restrictions on its use. Women using it in cancer therapy, for example, have to be on two forms of birth control, regular pregnancy testing. Some might see it as overkill, but it's meant that there've been no, so far as I'm aware, thalidomide babies in the first world as a result of its use in these modern applications. But in Brazil, it's an entirely different thing. Brazil has a large leper population. They're generally in remote areas where literacy is poor. Thalidomide is cheap. It's a generic drug now. It's off patent, so people produce it. It's a very cheap drug to produce. So there's widespread use of thalidomide in rural and remote areas of Brazil now for leprosy. It gets out of the hands of
Still manufactured by Grünenthal?
No, it's not. It's manufactured in, warehouses in Sao Paulo.
But they're not monitoring whether the women are pregnant or not?
No, well, it's getting out of the hands of people who are using it for leprosy. I mean, there's even anecdotal reports. The pills come with a silhouetted picture of a pregnant woman's belly with a line through it. And there are anecdotal reports of some people understanding that to mean it's an effective contraceptive pill. So women are taking it to avoid getting pregnant in some cases. And so there's a very large number of thalidomide babies being born in Brazil and other third world countries. That's where the real drama is today. And that's why there's some effort going on to engineer a leprosy-safe form of the drug. It is a very effective leprosy drug, and it's a useful multiple myeloma tool, but it's still a dangerous drug.
Yes, well, thanks very much for your very interesting talk tonight. Could you tell us why the case against Grünenthal didn't end up being successful? What are the reasons behind? Also, if you have an obvious case of unethical behaviour while complying with the regulations in place, and I think Grünenthal was then complying with the then existing pharmaceutical regulations in the early 1960s, what options do you have? Can think nowadays, what if your banker advises you to invest in something and bets against you, which is unethical but is perfectly legal? And also, knowing that you've had experience with asbestos, I don't know if you can draw a parallel with the case we've just talked about. I'm just thinking of ads from the mid 20th centuries, sort of advertising for asbestos as Christmas sprinkles, with kids sort of handling them. So, if you had the same sort of case of negligence.
That's a good question. And the sort of dichotomy between ethical and legal is interesting. The asbestos companies for years ran this defence that sort of ran like this. In the 1960s, we were exposing our workers willy-nilly all day, every day, to asbestos en masse. Everyone else was doing it too. All the other asbestos countries around the world were doing it. How could we have been... how can you consider that we were liable to our workforce when that was the industry standard at the time? And sometimes they even argue that they were complying with government regulations about air concentrations of asbestos. Well, it's all nonsense. Complying with government regulation doesn't get you off the hook. I'm not sure that there were real government regulations in Germany in the 1950s and 60s to do with pharmaceuticals. There were no standards for animal testing, for example. But your obligation, whether you're a pharmaceutical company or you're an asbestos company, your obligation is to, you know, fulfil your duty of care and provide a safe workplace for your employees. In the 1960s, if they cared to the asbestos companies, if they cared to investigate, they would have realised there was no safe level of exposure. Mesothelioma, lung cancer, or cancers of the pleura could be caused with any concentration of asbestos. So, for asbestos companies to argue everyone was ridiculously negligent, so you know, how can you hold us to account? And doesn't carry any weight. Just because the entire industry was outrageously negligent doesn't get them off the hook. Same for pharmaceutical companies. Grünenthal did and were entitled to argue that animal testing or reproductive testing was the minority. We were in the majority of companies that didn't. That just proved, you know, even if that were right, and we disputed that, even if that were right, it would just establish that most of them were outrageously negligent. You cannot start flogging a drug in pregnancy where you know that vulnerable embryos will get it if you haven't at least tried to check. Grünenthal getting off is, I suppose, the, you know, as Jill said, the settlement was a great, great, great moment. The only moment of pain was that we didn't hold Grünenthal to account. That isn't to say we settled for less. Diageo picked up the full tab. Grünenthal was lucky that they had a co-defendant who behaved in a responsible way and picked up the entire tab. We would have loved to have held to had a trial with Grünenthal, correct an historic wrong, hold them to account, show the ways in which they'd behaved. And there was, you know, there was so much evidence of their outrageous behaviour that we were confident we'd beat them at trial. But once Diageo had offered full compensation to everyone, you can't, it would be outrageously unethical behaviour for a lawyer to say, no, 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 we're not going to accept that because we want a moral victory over Grünenthal. We had to accept it. As much as we would have liked to hold Grünenthal to account, we had to accept the compensation package because it was fair and decent and substantial. And, you know, it hurt to do it, but we had to let Grünenthal go. We encouraged Diageo to bring their own cross claim against Grünenthal for contribution. We offered to help them if they did. I actually offered to work on it pro bono because I would have loved it. But so far as we know, they didn't do it. And, you know, Diageo just wanted to be rid of the whole thing. It was a pain in the neck for them. They wanted to seal it off and be done with it and, you know, have no ongoing relationship with Grünenthal.
Can you tell me from whence the title came?
Yes, well, there are two bases for the title. One is Wendy Rowe's account of that scene, because once Dickinson had, you know, I got Wendy's account of the scene in the delivery room when Lynn was born, and Wendy had had two daughters previously, and Wendy talked about how in the first two pregnancy there was chatter and congratulations and, you know, the sort of thing that goes on in the delivery room after the birth of a baby. But when Lynn was born, she said there was just a real silence and a sense of shock. So the silence and the shock comes from that. But then in a couple of months after we settled Lynn's claim for a multi-billion dollar sum, Grünenthal offered its first apology in 50 years. Grünenthal sent out its highly paid chief executive to give a speech in which he apologised for the damage done. It was a pretty weak and limp apology, but it was something. But then he poured fuel on the fire, or enraged thalidomidos and their families everywhere, by saying the reason it's taken us 50 years to issue this apology is that what we did to you caused us silent shock. So he used exactly the same expression. He said we were all in silent shock because of what we'd done to you. And thalidomidos, of course, thought that was ridiculous. I mean, they were the people and their families who were entitled to shock. not Grünenthal, which had made a, you know, a fortune out of the drug and had, you know, gone on to do other things and had taken, I mean, for a company that had taken 48 years to apologise, it was an outrageously poorly judged public relations moment.
A long time to have silent shock.
Yeah, hopeless. I mean, is that what happens to pharma companies? They, you know, kill and maim thousands of people and then lapse into silent shock for decades. It was ridiculous.
And thank you very much. And I think we should remember anyway that the lawyers did a very good job here and the journalist has also done a very good job. And you mightn't have nailed Grünenthal in court, but you've got him here.
Thanks, Jill.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.